Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Katie Beswick, who is a lecturer in drama at the University of Exeter. And Dr. Beswick's new book is called Social Housing and Performance, The English Council Estate on and Off Stage. So welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
This is an incredibly timely book. It speaks really directly to lots and lots of discussions that are going on in arts and cultural industries about social inequalities. And it's always strange with an academic book because they take sort of so long to write that they end up being, you know, kind of really well timed. And it'd be great to start off, I guess, with a kind of like little history of the project and where the project relates to your work more generally and your sort of interest in these questions of space and inequality.
Yeah. Well, the project starts off really in my early childhood. So I was born on a council estate, well, not on one. I was born in a hospital. I moved to a council estate when I was a baby. And we only lived there for a couple of years before my parents moved off and bought a house. And when I grew up, sort of most other people that I knew lived on estates, you know, pretty much all my friends. I think I only had one friend at secondary school who didn't live on an estate. A lot of my family lived on council estates. So I was always really aware of estate spaces and always really aware of the fact, you know, that we didn't live on one anymore, and that being kind of a, you know, kind of a thing that I knew about myself, and that it made me quite different, I suppose, from the environment that was around me. And then, you know, as I got older and went to university and things and started thinking about class, because, you know, when you grow up in a sort of working class area and most of the people around you are more or less working class, you know, you don't really think about class inequality. And then when I got to university, I went to the University of Exeter, where I now teach. I started to really think about, you know, my background, notice the sort of differences in, you know, the way that I thought about things, my behaviour, my experience to my peers. And I remember one tutor made a comment to me after I did drama, and I performed, and he made a comment to me about, you know, I'd done Ibsen, I think, and I'd played like a 70-year-old rich woman. And he, and in my critique, he was like, well, you know, that's difficult for you to play because you're just council estate and you'll never really be anything else. And it really sort of shocked me because, you know, I never really thought of myself in that way. And obviously I didn't live on a council estate for most of my childhood. So I guess that was the point at which I was like, oh, so, you know, this is a thing. And that comment really stayed with me, and I went to drama school and I trained to be a performer. And again, like the kind of roles that I was asked to do were always these really sort of like underclass kind of roles. And I just started thinking about, you know, how are these representations speaking to, you know, the people that I grew up with and the life that I, you know, come from. And I eventually decided I wanted to do a PhD and just start to think about how representations in theatre and, you know, arts practice were speaking to social housing environments. I also worked for a little while as a housing officer, which was kind of separate to it, that sort of totally solidified my thoughts about council estates, because as I, you know, I came out of drama school and just got a temp job as a housing officer, which I ended up doing for a few years. And that, you know, that just really started, again, just brought all of those questions about how are the representations of these environments speaking to the actual environments to the kind of forefront of my mind. And that was the point I applied and did a PhD looking at that stuff. And so the PhD isn't the book. So the book's quite different to the PhD, but that's the sort of the trajectory that I've been on for the last kind of 10 years working on the PhD and the book, if that answers the question.
I mean, that's a great setup, and it gives a real sense of your personal commitment to this issue, as well as actually the kind of broader context. You hinted at some of the negativity around this term, the council estate. Mm. It'd be good if you could kind of pin it down. I mean, you know, obviously English listeners will, you know, be kind of intimately familiar with the term, and, you know, bring a lot of the prejudices that you're seeking to challenge and kind of uncover in the book to that term. But it'd be good to hear a bit about what the term means, you know, the kind of like the specific context of the term in England or Britain, and then why it's got this negativity, why, you know, a tutor could kind of, you know, brand you as council estate in terms of your drama experience.
Yeah. So in my book, and I'll get to this in a bit more detail in a second, I use the term council estate in quite a specific way, but I think I'll save that for later. Broadly speaking, like when you use the word council estate, you're referring, in England anyway, to discrete areas of social housing, or discrete areas of housing that were once built as social housing, I should say. So they were once built as secure lifetime tenancies, provided a reasonable rent cost to people who couldn't afford to buy their homes. That's quite a brief, ultimately reductive description, but it gives some idea of sort of what the term means for people who aren't familiar with it. I guess the second thing to say is that council estates emerged in the UK from the late 19th to the early 20th century. And that was as a result of like a wave of social movements addressing issues around housing for the working class, around kind of problems that came up from slum conditions in the sort of late Victorian era. So, for example, a lot of early estates were built to home families moved out of slum conditions, or to, even if they weren't home in those families, to replace slums that were demolished. And then you have the Homes for Heroes after World War One, that's providing kind of safe, secure housing for a working class that's sort of been decimated through total war. And then post-Second World War, you've got the growth of the welfare state, and then the rebuilding of cities after bombing. And that's another big wave of council estate building. And I guess I go through those waves because what I want to sort of point up is that council estates weren't marginal at their inception and height. So by the end of the 1970s, you've got about, I think it's about 42% of the population living in social housing. Now, I know that's a contested statistic, but really my point is it wasn't a marginal tenancy. But then in 1980, you had the introduction of the right to buy policy, which was one of Margaret Thatcher's flagship policies, where huge discounts are given to council tenants who want to buy their own homes. So for people who've never been able to afford a home, suddenly they can. My nan, for example, bought a four-bedroom house with a huge back and front garden, and that was for about £8,000 in the 1980s. Now, even then, you know, you couldn't get a house for that much money. So this is the point where we start to see a massive shift in how the population see council housing. It starts to become a less desirable tenancy. Communities start fracturing because you have areas that were once totally social housing, like a lot of the new towns, for example, that then become stratified in terms of there's some owners, those owners sell the houses or rent those properties out. So there's private renters, and then there's the council tenants as well. And council tenancies start to become less desirable. You also obviously have a reduction in council housing. And then you fast forward to now, and I think we've got about 8% of the population in social housing. And now it's almost impossible to be homed in social housing unless you're very poor or vulnerable, which is not to sort of make any judgment on people who live in social housing. It's just to say, you know, what we've really done is gone back to this reliance on exploitative private renting. And meanwhile, house prices are rising to astronomical levels. And then there's other factors, obviously, in the housing crisis. But the whole trajectory of council housing, I think, tells the story of the housing crisis in the UK. And it shows the sort of historical points at which sort of society has been more or less interested in investing in our country so it works for everyone. And the points where we've been interested in sort of making profit for a few people. I guess the point I just want, again, there's sort of a third point I want to make, which is about... So in the book, I use the term council estate and I call it a generic term. So when you say the word council estate to a British person, as you sort of indicated at the start of this podcast, most British people, at least most English people, will have a particular bank of images and ideas in their mind that are going to be shared. And that's whether they've lived in an estate or not. And so the word is a cultural shorthand. And really what my research has been about is about thinking through how that shorthand's produced and what it means, which is actually quite complex. So one dominant aspect of the generic idea of the estate is in this loaded, negative, stigmatizing reputation. So estates are often framed in sort of newspaper stories about what happens on estates or in documentaries and so on as sort of spaces of low morals where there's crime, loose sexuality, bad taste, and these stigmatizing ideas are bound up with wider stigmatizations of working class people, and those have already been explored by a lot of the scholars that I cite in the book. So Bev Skeggs, Stephanie Lawler, Lisa McKenzie, Imogen Tyler, etc. They've all done a lot of work on really thoroughly mapping out that abject working class and how that, you know, operates through representation. But what I also want to say, and what I also say in the book, is that representation, or in representation of estates, this sort of abject negative depiction is dominant, but it isn't the only idea that circulates about estates. So there's also a certain fetishization of working class culture. There's a resistance from estate residents themselves, and there are nostalgic and sensational and beautiful depictions of estates as well. So I think, although that, you know, obviously that there is that negative discourse that's really central, it is more complex, even in, you know, representation, than just sort of estate equals totally negative.
I mean, the struggle over representation is the kind of the core of the front end of the book, both in terms of the kind of class politics of theatre, but also struggles over what is real and what is represented. And I guess, you know, we've set out, you know, some of the kind of political, social context for the council estate, and you've gestured to some of the empirical and theoretical work. But one really kind of obvious way to crystallise this is to take a couple of examples. And I guess we might do... you know, maybe one really obvious one where the politics of class and race intersect with representations of the estate. And that's the case of Mark Duggan, which is really important to the first chapter of the book. And telling that story, I think, would be a really straightforward illustration of all the things you've been talking about so far.
Yeah, so I guess I should just frame this by saying, so the first chapter of the book looks at what I call the quotidian performance of the council estate. So one of the things I'm concerned with is thinking about how the performance and the everyday exist on a spectrum, and the ways that actual people are depicted and the ways that actual people behave. are kind of this reciprocal kind of dynamic, operating this sort of reciprocal dynamic exchange, if that makes any sense. So I look at three examples. I look at Karen Matthews, who's a woman from Dewsbury Estate in the north of England, who was convicted for kidnapping her own daughter. I look at the pop star celebrity Cheryl Cole, whose council estate background is quite often referenced in interviews about her life. And then I look at Mark Duggan. So Mark Duggan was the young mixed race man killed by police in 2011, and his death sparked the 2011 riots. So he is sort of bound up with ideas of the estate because he's associated, he was raised on the Broadwater Farm estate in London, and the Broadwater Farm estate had, you know, in the 1980s, 85, I think, the Broadwater Farm riots, which are kind of iconic in sort of race class history, the history of the estate in the UK, and the tensions between the sort of black community and the police that epitomised those riots never really went away. So that what you have when Mark Duggan is killed is you have a press response and a sort of response from the state, which is this is a dangerous black gangster who is everything that inner city estates are. He is dangerous, he is criminal, he is corrupt, he is lacking in morals, and he deserved to die, and the people rioting in his name are also criminal, feral, underclass. And you have this as a really sort of strong initial response from politicians and the press. And then what you have is, and that's sort of the negative representation, and that is the way that that this sort of, you know, when I talk about reality and representation, it's like, at what point is there any truth in those depictions? And at what point is that narrative part of a kind of myth of the council estate that just gets played out through these individual figures? But then what you have that's really interesting with Mark Duggan is you have his family and supporters really contesting that narrative, and you have a really strong pushback. There's a really interesting documentary called The Hard Stop that offers an alternative perspective on what happened to Mark Duggan and on the conditions that kind of created his death and the emotional impact on his family. And again, that documentary goes back to the estate, and there's a really interesting moment when his cousin, I think it's his cousin or one of his friends, sort of talks about the estate as home to them, and this sort of flock of birds fly up, and it's really quite a beautiful moment where the estate looks different to the way that you often see it in these depictions. So really, I think the Mark Duggan example is interesting in that it shows this negative depiction, but it also shows how residents, how people who are affected by these negative representations in one way or another are able to also use representations of the estate to contest that dominant narrative and to mix things up a little bit. And, you know, that movement to get justice for Mark Duggan has really been bound up, or, you know, kind of at least contemporaneously, is that the right way to say it, with the Black Lives Matter movement. And so there's kind of a global element to all of this kind of race and class politics as well, that I think plays out really interestingly in the story of Mark Duggan. So that's what I'm hoping to kind of show in that section of that chapter.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, the thing that sort of comes up now is that, you know, we've talked a lot about, broad social inequalities. You know, you've talked there about, you know, a specific incident and media representations. Mm. Not really mentioned, like, theatre at all. No. So how does this connect and how does this kind of play out when we're thinking about contemporary performance? And I guess the sort of the middle part of the book is you know, dealing with, and correct me if I'm wrong actually, but, you know, kind of on stage, maybe like traditional, what we
I call it mainstream, but that's just mainstream theatre, but that, you know, it's really, I'm talking about subsidised building based
and then stuff that's more kind of site specific and deals with the estate as, you know, almost not something to be represented, but, you know, almost, you know, something to be kind of, in some cases, used as a, you know, a kind of backdrop for a performance. And the one that stood out was the discussion of Rita Sue and Bob 2.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, has been a film and also, you know, it's kind of had a bit of a revival as well. And that's got a very particular kind of like spatial class politics as well as gender politics to it.
Yeah, it has. So to answer the first part of your question, which is about how does all this feed into the theatre or what's all this got to do with the theatre? So, you know, theatre is a representational form, obviously, and this book is coming out of a, broadly speaking, it's an interdisciplinary book, but broadly speaking, a performance studies tradition. So I am interested in how these representations all play out in plays. And, you know, I do a little bit of mapping of that in the Mark Duggan section, where I talk a little bit about a few plays that kind of were produced around that time or leading up to that time. And you can sort of see how the media discourse is coming out in the plays and then how the plays are sort of in some ways sort of authenticating that media discourse or occasionally challenging it or making it a bit more complicated, but often not doing so. And then in the chapter on what I call mainstream plays, what that's really about, so as your work has evidenced, there's a big problem in subsidised theatre in arts as a profession with class participation. So there are barriers to access for creative workers from working class backgrounds. And subsidised or mainstream theatre spaces aren't catering or aren't perceived to cater to working class audiences. So theatre is perceived, and to some extent is, a culturally elite space, and a huge demographic of the population are excluded from participating in that. And until, sort of, as you said, this book sort of comes at a time when suddenly no one's been speaking about this, and now everybody seems to acknowledge that this is an issue, and that's great. And so class has been more or less visible, and particularly less visible in policy initiatives that seek to address even issues of class inequality, really. So I have this whole section in the book where I talk about the Arts Council's Taking Part survey and how that does a really weird job of sort of talking about class without ever actually using the word class. And while all this is going on, all of this sort of, we don't want to acknowledge that class exists, or we don't want to really talk about the problem in a sort of, in anything other than a euphemism or kind of in hidden terms, you have that going on in policy, and that's both sort of funding policy and in theatre policy, theatre's own policies. But meanwhile, you do have working class people frequently depicted on stage, particularly in social realist representations. And in these representations, the estate often appears as sort of a signifier or as another moral euphemism that flags up, you know, these characters are working class. So you'll either get the play being set on an estate, or you'll get a working class character talking about being from an estate, or the estate will be referenced in one way or another. But because of these barriers to participation at the levels of sort of creation and consumption, these mainstream depictions often feel a bit like poverty porn. So what I do in chapter two is I take specific productions of plays. So I'm not thinking, so I look at Rita Sue and Bob too, but I'm not really thinking about that as a play text on its own. So I'm not really commenting on Andrea Dunbar's writing. And I think that's quite an important distinction to make. What I'm doing is I'm looking at the 2000 production, which actually then toured in 2001 too, but was conceived in 2000. And that was performed in tandem with a verbatim play called A State Affair, first performed at the Soho Theatre and then toured. And what I do with that is I start to tease out this story of how Andrea Dunbar works in this play as this kind of authentic voice of the working class. She's presented as the writer, as this authentic voice. So on the one hand, you have that sort of absolute authenticity of the writer. But then on the other hand, what you have is a really unequal class and power dynamics operating in the theatre institutions where the plays are created and performed. And also in through those institutions, such as sort of critics, where the plays are received. And they crystallise into these this really sort of ambivalent depiction of council estates and working class people. So, you know, you have this depiction in Rita Sue and Bob Two of these girls who are, who, by all sort of moral middle class dominant standards, are kind of morally lax. They're 15, they're having an affair with their babysitter who's married, and they don't really seem to care about that. They haven't got any kind of they're not sort of examining their own morality, and you don't get the sense in the play that they're being groomed, although obviously there is now, especially with all this sort of recent hideous stories of the total exploitation of working class girls, that lens that you might want to then put back on it. But that's not what's happening in the story. And I think that critics especially have found that really hard to reconcile, this sort of depiction of an estate that they recognize, but it isn't the, you know, the depiction in itself is quite celebratory in a lot of ways, and it speaks with voices that are sort of recognizably working class, and with a language and a lens that obviously comes from somebody who understands the texture of what's being put on stage. But then you also have this mediation, this critical response, and this realist performance form that are kind of determined to offer the same reductive, hopeless, council estate poor, council estate hopeless narrative. And that's kind of reinforced again by the verbatim play A State Affair, which one of the writer of that, Robin Soans, went back to the estate and to Leeds and Bradford more widely, and did lots of interviews in order to write that play. And you sort of get an even more hopeless estate than the one that we've left in the 1980s with Andrea Dunbar. Although, again, you know, I talk in the book about how actually, you know, when you see the play on stage, it is more nuanced than that.
And you get similar themes coming up with site-specific performance where, yeah, I guess people have kind of gone in with, again, almost exactly that kind of cultural baggage and that sense of doing some speaking for sites and speaking for places, which end up replicating these kind of cliches and inaccurate depictions. I guess, though, I mean, I think you set that out really, really usefully, but it might be worth highlighting the way you try and nuance this a bit. And one of the things you're really keen to do is stress that we shouldn't have a kind of binary analysis of theatre's role here. And we shouldn't just, you know, kind of think of almost a sort of, you know, kind of colonization or an exchange of, you know, individual stories for stuff that can make, you know, directors famous or whatever. And it'd be interesting to hear some of those kind of critiques of these sorts of binary positions.
Yeah, so one of I'm going to start by talking about one of the plays that I talk about, which is called Slick. So Slick was a site-specific piece. So I move out of the mainstream theatre chapter with Andrea Dunbar and all of that, and I leave that in chapter two, I think, and then I move into a chapter that looks at plays that are what I call located on the estate, so site-specific works. And particularly I'm interested in those estates in the context of urban regeneration or redevelopment, I think. So one of the examples I write about is a National Youth Theatre project called Slick. So that was a site-specific project, 2011 it was performed, and it was explored. So it was part of a trilogy of these really large plays. So they had about 300 performers. And this trilogy of plays explored the environmental, it was a sort of environmentalism, environmental trilogy. And this particular play, Slick, explored the impact of plastic in the seas and oceans. So in that play was performed on the Parkhill estate in Sheffield. And the estate in the sort of world of the play was this ship, the estate's blocks that were a ship on which the audience would get on. And we walked through the estate onto this island called Utopia. So in the performance, the audience become part of the action. And we see how, as we travel through this ship, we meet these stowaways who tell us how this sort of seemingly utopian project, where gap year students are travelling out to this island to participate in the environmental cleanup of plastics from the ocean, is actually really corrupt and exploitative. And we start to see that there's stowaways on ships trying to escape from the island that's really exploiting them for profit. And the play was really interesting in the sense that, so the Parkhill was undergoing a regeneration, which was quite controversial, by a company called Urban Splash. That regeneration is still ongoing. And as part of that regeneration, which is going to see a huge reduction, or has seen a huge reduction, in the number of homes available for social rent, so that council estates function as a sort of social housing becomes completely decimated. The developers, Urban Splash, have used art as a means to sell the positive vision for the estate's future. So there's been numerous art projects that have happened on the estate. I talk a bit about that. There's a very famous piece of graffiti, I Love You, Will You Marry Me, that's been depicted in kind of this neon sign. So art practice ends up becoming quite complicit in this development, which is part of a wave of developments that are massively reducing the capacity for social housing and profiting from the housing bubble, the displacement of working class communities, and often profiting from working class sort of art and culture too. So in Slick, the sort of tension that's really interesting that comes up in the play is the play, with this sort of critique of this utopian project that then kind of falls into corruption, is seemingly aware of its own role in the positive reframing of Park Hill as this edgy site for property investment. So although the play is still part of this so-called art washing, so it conceals this violence of speculative property redevelopment from view by being this play put on by young people, celebrating the architecture of the Parkhill. At the end of the play, there's 200 dancers, and then, you know, 30 or 40 aerial performers coming down the building that's picked out in these amazing neon lights. That's the cover to the book, actually. So it's this quite spectacular, amazing performance that, you know, really doesn't give you time to think about what's actually going on at the level of the redevelopment. But the production itself doesn't play a straightforward role in this model. So the artwork is critiquing itself as it's happening. And so you can't really say that it's totally complicit in the redevelopment, because clearly it isn't, but it's also not complicit either. So when I talk in the book about these really reductive analyses, or these really reductive conversations about art happening in the context of redevelopment, I'm not really talking about scholarship so much as I'm talking about the sort of public debate, particularly the online debate. So there is a lot of nuance in a lot of recent arts criticism, especially people like Jen Harvey, Cecilia Sachs Olsen, and Anna Minton has just done a book with Dan Hancock's and a bunch of other people called Regeneration Songs. And they're all acknowledging that there is this ambivalence in a lot of arts practice that takes place in the context of regeneration. But that kind of nuance never seeps out into the public debate. And so you either get these projects that are painted as kind of really amazing kind of beacons for community engagement and the works of social good, or you get these conversations where the artist is absolutely an art washer, they're complicit in gentrification, it's their fault that gentrification's happening. And what I think is that even where a work is really, really flawed and we hated it, or where it was really compromised politically, or alternatively where we thought it was amazing, we have to try and think about the context through which it's working and the different layers it's working on. So people seem to want to point to artworks and say that's really crass and stereotypical, or that's really obscure and elitist. And like, yes, that is often the case, but there is normally more going on than that. And I think this is important, not just from a sort of academic point of view, but I think what we do by not allowing ambivalence in the public debate is we degrade artwork and we degrade the whole sphere of arts and culture. And in doing that, in making these public debates where art is slated all the time or trivialised or criticised or told it's complicit in these awful neoliberal processes, which of course it is, because we all are. But that is one of the ways that the system works to keep working class people out. This is what I believe. I think they aren't, you know, they aren't stripping arts education out of private schools. They are giving young people that go through elite education the tools with which to understand sort of nuanced ways that art works. You know, it's only frivolous and pointless and dangerous and damaging for our children and our families. We're the people who are not encouraged to see the value of artworks because, you know, the system doesn't want to enable working class people to take up those spaces in the cultural industry sector, because then who's going to do, you know, all the work that nobody else wants to do? So I think we owe it to ourselves really to engage with the ambivalence of creative practices and to really think about what it's doing and to find the moments at which art is really enabling us to see things differently or to think differently, and opening us up to realms of sort of beauty and care and kind of aesthetic transcendence or you know, whatever other term you want to use. I think I talk about Paul Crowther's, well, I do talk about Paul Crowther's idea of the sensuous manifold in the book quite a lot. Yeah, so it is a kind of political point for me as well, this idea of embracing the ambivalence in these artworks rather than just a sort of me trying to have an academic, totally academic debate about what's going on in the artworks.
I mean, we've only really scratched the surface of really. a lot more in terms of the analysis of the examples, the kind of conclusion and sort of final sections of the book look precisely at that defence of theatre practice, which is subversive, you know, which offers, you know, really kind of direct challenges and, you know, contests things like nostalgia and this kind of stuff. But I guess the sort of, and, you know, you've offered, you know, a kind of political defence actually of most of those things at a time when, as you say, there is a specific class politics associated with questions about access to the arts, you know, and who is allowed and who is not allowed. Not just that, actually, to do these things, but as the book says, into the very spaces of cultural production. But I guess the way to wrap up is, I suppose, a sort of broader question of where you go next with this analysis. It struck me in the book that there might be, you know, a sort of creative set of responses to the book's work. And I know on Twitter, one of the artists you talk about has kind of, you know, highlighted how fantastic it is to be kind of, you know, recognised for your creative practice in this context. So I just wonder what's next for this analysis, or is it the case that you've sort of had quite enough of the council estate and, you know, you want to do something completely different?
No, I mean, I'm really interested in writing about cultural what am I trying to say? I'm really interested in writing about plays, theatre, culture that is overlooked by the sort of elite cultural sphere, and in writing about working class artists, particularly, who don't get a lot of scholarship written about them. So Conrad Murray, who I'm a big fan of his work, and I write about his work in the book, and he's been really nice online actually about the book, and really pleased to have his work included. And I hope he's not going to mind me say this, but I'm hoping to shadow the rehearsal process of his next show and write something about that. You know, what I'll write and what form it will take, I've got no idea yet. So I'm definitely interested in continuing to write about these kind of contexts and so on. And I'm interested in seeing how some of the ideas that I have play out in different spaces. So one of the things we haven't talked about in the book is its whole sort of spatial dimension in terms of the theoretical work, but that's fine. But I'm interested in, for example, my new project, my new sort of big project, my next book project, is about the street as I don't think the street isn't a generic space in the same way that Council Estate is a generic space, but the street as a stage for performance and the street as a sort of idea that circulates in culture in one way or another is very interesting to me. You know, we also haven't really talked, there's a whole thread about hip hop in the book, which is really important to me and interesting to me, and about the sort of power of hip hop as this cultural form that has, of course, been completely co-opted by neoliberalism, but that still somehow manages to speak to people and come out and be useful to offering a voice for people who come out of marginalised, I hate that term, but, you know, marginalised communities, conditions on the margins. And for people, you know, bell hooks talks about clinging to the margin as like a strategy of resistance. And I talk in the book a little bit about how hip hop is a form that enables that clinging to the margin. So I'm interested in thinking about the street as a physical space, as an idea, about hip hop particularly. I've been doing the last sort of 4 or 5 years, I've been following a dance form in New York called Light Feet that happens on subway trains. And I've been working with some of the dancers that invented that form and perform it, and thinking about a lot of these questions about cultural representation, resistance, co-option of artworks into the sort of sphere of capitalism through Light Feet. So that's sort of what I'm hoping, that's where I'm hoping to take, you know, this sort of discussion for my next work. But yeah, I'm working on a lot of stuff, so at the moment, like, different chapters and this next book, in fact next two books, I'm also interested in taking out, there's a whole strand of the second chapter that's about promiscuous working class women. I don't know if that sort of came out for you, but I'm really interested in thinking about this figure of the slag. And, you know, we used to, that's what my school was called Plumpton Manor, and we used to be called Slaggy Manor, and because it was a girls' school where a lot of girls got pregnant very before we left school, and so it had this whole reputation. And I'm interested in thinking again about how this figure sort of plays out on stage and particularly through realist representations. So yeah, I've got a lot of ideas that I'm working with.